Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. My name's Eamon Murphy. I'm Economic and Social Analyst with Social Justice Ireland. Hopefully you're all keeping safe and well in these difficult times. When the programme for government for the current Dáil was published a few months back, one of the most notable aspects and one of the ones that we most strongly welcomed was the reference to the need for a new social contract. This week, SJI published our commentary on the idea of the social contract. It contains dozens of policy recommendations that would go a considerable way towards building a new social contract suitable for Ireland in the 21st century, with the goal of improving the quality of life and well-being for everyone and ensuring that no one is left behind as our economy and society recovers from the impact of COVID-19. In this week's podcast episode, I chat with my colleague Colette Bennett about the idea of the social contract and some of the things that are required in order to meet the lofty aspirations contained in the programme for government. We also look to Budget 2021 in 3 weeks' time, which is the government's first opportunity to properly lay a platform for the building of this new society. You can read the full document on our website, socialjustice.ie. In the meantime, hope you enjoy the episode.
So, a big week for Social Justice Ireland, Colette. We've published a fairly substantial commentary on this much discussed and much anticipated new social contract that was mentioned in the programme for government. If I do say so myself, it's a fine piece of work. I think a lot of the credit goes to yourself for compiling it. I mean, what's your reaction thus far to the pickup that we've gotten within the media, the interest we've gotten from some of our supporters and from various policymakers? I mean, the litmus test, I suppose, is going to be in the upcoming budget in 3 weeks' time to see whether the government is really serious about making the investments that are required. But what are your immediate thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I was happy to see the coverage that it did get, and I think it got a pretty good piece in a couple of the national publications. Our own membership have been in touch around, you know, what their view on it was, and that's all obviously been very positive. As you say, the real litmus test is going to be whether any of it makes it into the budget in a couple of weeks' time. You know, and I think I'm kind of concerned, I suppose, about where the budget is going to go in terms of, we had a programme for government published a while ago. There was a lot in it that we welcomed when we did our initial review on it. A lot of stuff we would have been advocating for, and that was really, really positive. But again, it comes down to, that's all fine for now, but, you know, we've seen successive programmes for government not meet up to their expectations and not live up to the promises that were made. I'm concerned particularly about this budget because I think it's a really crucial one, because it's, you know, given where we are in terms of the pandemic, there's a lot to be done with it, and because of that, almost, it provides a lot of cover. So while it should be a well-being budget, it should be a budget that starts to underpin a social contract in the way that we would talk about it, it may also be cast or framed as a budget that was just very, very difficult to put together and the economy came first. And if we continue looking at it like that, we're going back down the direction of austerity, which no one really wants to go into.
Yeah, it's a real scene setter, isn't it? I mean, the government's likely to have to deal with substantial deficits for, you know, if it runs for 5 years, it'll probably have to deal with five budgets that have a significant deficit. So how they decide to go about it, will there be spending cuts, will there be tax increases, or will they do the sensible thing, try to maintain the economic capacity as much as is possible and sort of ring fence a lot of the deficit there and borrow as is required? What we know is going to be substantially low rates. It is, as you say, an opportunity to lay the foundations for what was a proposed social contract in that programme for government. But that term social contract, I mean, I learned about it first going back almost 20 years ago, first year politics in UCD. You know, back then I kind of sort of viewed it as a bit of an antiquated concept. It was written about by political philosophers who were in many cases dead for hundreds of years. At the time, it was just this idea that individuals in society, they've consented, whether explicitly or tacitly, to surrender a lot of their freedoms, to submit to authority, so whether that's to a king, as it would have been hundreds of years ago, or to a democratically elected government. But, you know, they consented to be governed in exchange for a certain amount of security and protection laws would be enforced, property would be protected, you know, murder and other serious crimes were punished. Basically, the social order would be maintained. Now, that's not what we're talking about in this social contract. I think things have moved on a lot. We're in 2020. The expectations of the citizens of a developed Western democracy like Ireland have changed, or more might be more appropriate to say that they've increased. You know, people nowadays expect a certain level of social provision, whether that be in health or education or a good number of other areas. They expect government to protect not just people anymore, but also the environment as well. I mean, where do you see the kind of the priorities of being within this social contract, this putative social contract that Social Justice Ireland has put forward, and where should priorities be for this government?
Well, I think, first of all, when you talk about what the social contract used to be a couple of hundred years ago, you have to remember as well that the political landscape then was all in favour of the landowners, was all in favour of a particular class. And not necessarily that our priorities have changed. And if anybody is tuned into the kind of housing situation, they might think that our priorities haven't changed at all. But more in terms of, well, what does a society need? So it needs more than just shelter. It needs more than the provision of food. It needs, you know, it needs a society and what's involved in that. And as we progress, you know, when women started to work, part of the social contract became, well, how do we mind our children? So childcare became an important part of it. And we've seen, for example, you know, the very, very heavy burden that can, you know, fight both financially, but also in terms of when we're talking about remote work, as we have been, you know, where that burden falls, and it tends to be gendered. And there's plenty of studies that have come out in the last couple of months around that. But, you know, so things like childcare have become an expectation, and it's a need rather than a want. Things like healthcare have become an absolute priority. Things like, you know, decent work. So now that for the right reasons, and unions have definitely played their part, you know, there is an expectation that there should be decent work. So the advent of precarious employment is a real step back in that regard, and a real difficulty. So when we talk about underpinning a social contract, we're back to this five-pillar framework. So you have your decent economy, and you talked about, you know, addressing the deficit. So ring-fencing the deficit that has been created by the current pandemic, borrowing at low rates to deal with that and to deal with the fallout, the kind of current expenditure fallout of that. But then looking at, well, what else does society actually need? So in terms of, you know, this vibrant economy, we look at things like decent work, and we look at things like budgetary responsibility. Then we go on to, you know, our decent services and infrastructure. And this is probably what you're talking about in terms of what people might expect from the state.
That vibrant economy as well. But it's kind of it's also the main thing that people do expect from the state. Whether they think about it in those terms or not, they do expect that certain minimum in healthcare, in education. They don't expect to see thousands of people homeless, do they?
No, nor should they. You know, there was that thing a couple of years ago, homelessness is normal. It absolutely isn't, nor should it be in a country that was listed in the top five richest in the world. So, you know, underpinning then those decent services and infrastructure, and we talk healthcare and housing and childcare and work and all of those things and education, we move on then to, well, how do you pay for it going forward? If this is to be a sustainable plan into the future, if we're not, you know, just dealing with the COVID emergency, but we're actually looking forward, then you're looking at things like a just taxation system. And something I got asked in the last couple of days in relation to that was, well, you know, at a time when we're looking at increased unemployment, are you really talking about taxing people more? And it's that, you know, it's just trying to get that point across that we're not just talking about income tax. We're not saying, it's totally understandable that people are thinking about their own pockets. Of course they are. But that's not where we're looking at. We're looking at the tax relief system. We're looking at, in terms of, you know, environmentally damaging things that can be taxed. So it's more about broadening our tax base, which is something we've been asked to do for years now and really haven't grappled with at all.
And I mean, perception that the tax take is just income tax is actually quite damaging as well to people's understanding of how the overall system works. I mean, we talk about, when I say we, I mean, Social Justice Ireland talks about how Ireland's tax take, regardless of how it gets measured, is so far away from the European norm. So it kind of stands to reason that we should only be able to expect realistically services that are quite far from the European norm as well. I think an understanding from people that the tax take is about more than just income tax, that there are so many different areas that are undertaxed in Ireland, including our ability to tax land and property, our willingness to maybe ask employers to pay a fair share of social security. You look at some of the corporate entities that are based in Ireland who are paying such low corporation tax rates. And, you know, I guess getting the message out there to people that paying for the social services, the infrastructure, the new social contract that they expect, it's going to involve increasing revenue from those sources, and it doesn't have to be necessarily a hit to their personal pocket. It can be done in a much fairer way.
Yeah, I mean, part of what we have in this document, we've made this proposal before, is this idea that you can actually generate between 2.5 and 3 billion in additional taxes per annum and still be competitive, actually still retain our exact position in terms of our competitiveness. And it was a question I was asked yesterday. It was like, oh, you're going to increase income tax by 2.5 to 3 billion. It's like, no, that's not where that is. And the example I tend to go back to is that piece from the CSO last year around the potentially environmentally damaging subsidies and tax reliefs. But that's foregoing, like the state is foregoing 4.1 billion a year. So, you know, we're not even looking at all of that when we talk about 2.5 to 3 billion, and we're not only looking at that either. So it's spreading that, it's that thing of broadening the base. Then obviously we've got our fourth pillar, which is the good governance side of things, that there has to be, you know, a proper, and one of the key parts of this is that proper idea of social dialogue, that all of the social partners can get around the table and can discuss the decisions that are being made at a societal level. So this idea that policy has nothing to do with you or to do with, you know, the ordinary person on the street is a nonsense. And if that's the case, then everybody should get to have a say. So the example I tend to use, and I'm talking about it, is the loaf of bread. You cannot buy a loaf of bread without, you know, being impacted by policy, from what's in it to how much it costs to how it's packaged to where the ingredients are put on it to all of that. You know, that they're down to a myriad of different policies. So to say, for anyone to say the policy doesn't affect them and therefore it's okay to exclude certain sectors of society from having this engagement around how policies are formed and how they impact on people is just a nonsense. So it's really around getting involved and making sure that the right people are involved in those policy processes and in decision making.
That particular aspect is going to be especially important if the government is serious about a new social contract being sort of a new departure for Irish society. Because if we're planning on building something new, something kind of fairer, more just, and most importantly, more sustainable, you're going to need buy-in from all sectors of society for it to work. And I think that people are much more willing and much more likely to buy into that, to support decisions that are made, if they've actually been involved in making the decisions themselves. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is going to get everything they ask for. And I guess the different parties, the different stakeholders going into things need to acknowledge that in advance. But the main thing is that government, the key policymakers, the people with whom the final decision will always rest, that they listen to the different sectors of society, whether that be civil society and the community and voluntary sector, of which we ourselves are members, whether it be the agricultural sector, the trade unions, employers' bodies. Everybody needs to be around that table. If you're not at the table sitting with the key decision makers, you're basically going to be left with the crumbs from the meal, which is why it's so important that everybody is involved in a proper structure of social dialogue, one with power dynamics left at the door and a focus on evidence-based solutions to the many challenges that we face in Ireland. And, you know, we faced all of them before COVID. COVID has just given this a new context and in many cases a new imperative. But all those problems we had before, whether it be being the only European country, the only country in Western Europe without a properly accessible single-tier universal healthcare system, whether it be record levels of homelessness, underinvestment in education, and all the issues that go with our status as being a climate laggard. Those problems are still there. Some of them have only gotten worse. Some new opportunities have been presented, but these problems still have to be addressed. And, you know, Budget 2021 is going to be, you know, the first step, hopefully, towards it, towards coming up with solutions for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, back at the last recession, back in 2008, you know, the imposition of austerity when that came in, and Ireland went above and beyond what it was being asked to do in terms of, you know, the austerity measures that were implemented and things like cutting public services. The fact that there weren't social partners around the table, you know, talking about the impact of cuts on social services that disproportionately affect those on lower incomes, you know, that was just missed. That just was ignored for all the world, because it was more of a drain on the public purse. But actually, what that meant was that people couldn't get to work. You know, when they had the jobs, albeit low-paying jobs, they couldn't get there because things like public transport had been cut. Things like your local guard station had been cut. Things like local branch offices of post offices and things had been cut. So, you know, we need to avoid going down that route again, and actually looking at, well, how do we build a society, looking at it from a societal level with all factions of society, whether, as you say, you know, it's farmers, it's businesses, it's the environmental sector, it's the social inclusion and the community and voluntary sector. You know, it all needs to be considered if anything is going to be sustainable. And then obviously that brings us to the fifth pillar of our version of the social contract, which is sustainability. And again, you know, when you think of sustainability, you think, or people tend to think, environmental sustainability. And that is obviously a factor that's a big part of what we're talking about. But it's also in terms of sustainability into the future. So looking at sustainable employment, looking at sustainable services, looking at sustainable public sector, looking at its sustainability in terms of a just transition, and a just transition that supports both the environment and low-income households and rural Ireland, so that we're not, you know, expecting any sector of society to take on an unreasonable burden. It's something that we have to all address and all do it together.
And part of that sustainability is obviously, it involves making sure that the economic growth that Ireland is going to experience in the next few years, and hopefully I'm not being too optimistic in that, it needs to be much more evenly spread, not just socioeconomically, but also regionally as well. We've got this situation where several regions of Ireland have fallen so far behind, not just the capital, albeit we're already in a situation where Dublin is producing about half the GDP of the country. But, you know, an even spread is just as important for sustainability. And, you know, part of our social contract is obviously the need for new indicators of progress. We've referred to them in the past as satellite national accounts. We've referred to it as a sustainable progress index. But whatever way the government decides to approach it, we are sort of long past a time where there needs to be an alternative measure of well-being in this country that's not focused solely on economic product, GDP, GNP, GNI, whatever it is you decide to focus on. We need to find a new index to measure how Ireland is doing compared to our European peers, and also compared to how we've done in the past, whether that be in relation to how well we're doing at providing basic healthcare, at housing our people, in relation to our climate targets, and, you know, a good number of areas beside, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept of having those kind of satellite accounts is that we attribute a value to natural resources. And we, you know, we have kind of a deficit on the other side, or a subtraction on the other side, for anything that harms that. You know, and that's a part of all of that. And I think, you know, I think there's a really good piece in the Socioeconomic Review around that in the sustainability section. You know, if people want a bit more information on what we're talking about when we talk about those kind of satellite accounts or this new, you know, indicator. I think, you know, particularly for Ireland, there's just something perverse around the fact that we're still talking about GDP after 2015, when we know that it is, you know, a complete fallacy when we look at ours.
That's true. And it's not just about the fact that it's so overinflated and is so disconnected from the economic reality on the ground in a lot of cases. It's also that GDP contains so much that's actually damaging to society, not just to Irish society, but to society in general, and also excludes so much that contributes to well-being. I mean, one thing you could never accuse Social Justice Ireland of is being short on suggestions. We don't just complain about the current situation. We make evidence-based proposals for how things could be fixed or improved. Just to take some of the examples here that have gone into our social contract publication from earlier in the week. One of them is that the government should set a target of 20% of all the housing stock in Ireland to be social housing. Maybe you could tell our listeners where that 20% came from.
Yeah, I mean, you rightly said that we're not short of suggestions. I mean, I'd say we're not short of solutions to some of the issues and some of the causes of what we're talking about when we talk about inequality. So, for example, you know, one of the areas that I'm in particularly interested in, as you say, is housing. And that figure in relation to 20%, that's a relatively conservative figure taken from a European study. So if you look at some European countries, they have 30% social housing. So the likes of Austria, who are the model of housing, really, you know, they've got a really functional private rented market based on predominantly on cost rental in Vienna, known as the Vienna model. And it's something that, you know, other countries are trying to emulate, ourselves included. So they, you know, they're looking at 30%. There are other countries in and around the kind of 25, 20%. We're at 9%. So 9% of our housing stock is social housing. And it's, you know, it's just not good enough. So when we've got, you know, this market that up until March of this year was going through the roof in terms of private housing, in terms of private rent costs, we need to address that, and it needs to be an adequate response to that. And a more adequate response would be, again, rather than lagging behind our EU peers, as we do when it comes to, as you said, climate change, and we do as when it comes to properly housing and accommodating our citizens, we should be looking to emulate them, and we should be providing the capital and current expenditure to do that. There's been plenty of studies done over in the last couple of weeks, actually, in relation to how much it actually costs. And what we're doing when we buy public housing as opposed to developing our own public housing is we're paying well above the odds. So it's turning out to be more expensive on top of everything else. And that obviously then leaves less money in the pot to do other things, you know, and other things, whether it's in a different policy area, such as health, where we know there are plenty of issues, such as education, where we know educational disadvantage is still an issue, or whether it's in the housing sphere itself. So, for example, we look at rental inspections. There's a very, very low rate of rent inspections on private rented properties. And of the ones that are inspected, the rate of those that are non-compliant is excessively high. We're talking in above 80%. So, you know, obviously there's a concentration on those properties that are known to be particularly bad. That's how the data kind of presents itself. If you're doing such a low level of inspections, and within that, there's a very, very high level of non-compliance. But that just means that there are a lot of properties that are out there that are substandard and that are a significant health risk. And particularly now, and we can see the impact of things like light touch regulation on the housing market, things like build them high, build them small, not having cross ventilation, all of that, you know, this build to rent market, the student driven market, where the standards were, you know, intentionally lower because they weren't meant to be long-term homes. They're turning into long-term housing because we've had a housing crisis, and because of that, there are people who are suffering health consequences, whether that's through mold or whether it's because we have an airborne pandemic at the moment. So, yeah, I mean, we need to grapple the whole housing area, and I know I've just gone on well above your 20% social housing question, but you know, it is an area that I think is just so critical to how we live and to how we engage as a society. You know, if you don't have somewhere to rest, somewhere to, you know, sleep deprivation is a form of torture for a reason. If you don't have somewhere to properly rest yourself, then how can you ever hope to function, and how can you hope to support a family? How can you possibly hope to get up and do a day's work? And you know, I have nothing but admiration for the, you know, 1500, I think it's actually slightly lower now, it's about 1200 families that are living in emergency accommodation, because, you know, it's an insurmountable expectation of them, and they deserve much, much better.
I think a key part of any real social contract that's fit for a 21st century democracy would involve setting a floor underneath which people can't slip in terms of their living standards, whether that be the money in their pocket or the services that they have access to. And there's a lot of groups in society that we would have identified over the years as being particularly vulnerable. People with disabilities, for example, who always experience a greater level of deprivation and poverty than the national average, in fact, well higher than the national average. You look at some of the people who do the most socially imperative work that there is, in caring roles, for example, people who live in direct provision centres, people who experience domestic violence. And one of the themes, if there is anything connecting all of these people, and it's that the state, to a greater or lesser extent, tends to regularly let them down. It often pays really good lip service to them, but rarely provides the support that they actually need in order to achieve kind of a tolerable or decent existence. With so much on the agenda ahead of Budget 2021 and so much distraction in relation to COVID-19, I must say I wouldn't be overly confident that the government is going to change its approach. I know it's a new government, so maybe it's unfair to tar them with the same brush that we have previous ones, but is there scope for any inroads to be made into improving the lives of some of these people? And I'm sure that I've left many out, that's just a sample now of the ones, but the situations, particularly for people living in direct provision centres, as the publicity that the conditions there have received over the last few years has greatly increased the awareness of that. You'll be well aware, having spoken to Carol Bowman last week, that our obligations in relation to domestic violence victims under the Istanbul Convention are far from being met. It's disgraceful, actually, how far away we are from actually meeting them.
I think, again, if we went back to the programme for government, and if the current government was to really stand over the commitments that it made in that, I think we would go a long way to supporting many of the groups that you talk about. So there, it does talk about people with disabilities. It does talk about, you know, getting rid of direct provision. It does talk about domestic abuse as being an epidemic and things that need, you know, things that are needed to address it. You know, so I think certainly there's a lot to build on there. But I think, as I said earlier on, my concern is that it will just be part of the noise. It'll be that the pandemic has almost given cover for a different type of budget altogether, and I don't think it should be stood for. You know, I think something that we have unfortunately been very good at in this country for many years is hiding our problems, is hiding, you know, like, so direct provision on the outskirts of communities or on the outskirts of rural Ireland or wherever, you know, we don't see it, we don't think about it, it doesn't exist unless it's sitting at our front door. And there's been a lot of really good work done in the last couple of years to highlight the conditions of people who are living in direct provision. Same kind of thing with, you know, domestic abuse and domestic violence, that thing of, well, because it's so rarely reported. So if you consider the statistics on it, that 1 in 5 Irish women will experience domestic abuse in the course of their life. That's a huge amount of people. But because it's one of those things that and particularly for women, that they're conditioned to feel shame around it, then they don't talk about it. So it's hidden. And if it's hidden and it's not talked about, then it's going to be at the back of the queue for funding. So it's important to talk about these kind of issues. It's important to look at the ills of society and what can be improved on. But then, as you say, it's also important to have the solutions to that. So it's not enough to just point it out and to shine a light on it. You have to actually come up with something else. So it's interesting, you know, that because all of this has been acknowledged now, then the next step is putting your money where your mouth is and funding it and funding supports for it. And, you know, when we were talking about the notion of satellite accounts and the notion of what is and isn't in GDP, we kind of missed out on the notion of decent work and work not being synonymous with having a job. So, for example, the reliance on whether it's community volunteering or whether it's working in the home and carers, that has to be properly acknowledged and acknowledged in terms of funding it. Like, people need to live, people need to eat, people need to clothe themselves. And it's all well and good telling people they're doing a great job and giving them an award or whatever, but that's not going to feed them. So, you know, we do need to take it more seriously. I think in terms of whether or not anything will be done, I am hopeful but cautious that this budget is going to deliver any real improvements for people. How about you?
My worry is that there is so much on the agenda that government will do the politically expedient thing and tackle some big headline issues whilst ignoring other less high profile but equally important problems or challenges. I think one of the things that we focus on in pushing this model for a social contract with our five pillars is the need to tackle each of them together. You can't just focus on one or two or three and hope that the others will follow. It needs to be all five. And within each of those pillars, there's a need to ensure that each of those vulnerable groups that I've mentioned, plus other ones that exist as well, are looked after and are brought along, that this is a budget that doesn't leave anybody behind, and that there's no excuse for it, even if the government is facing a significant deficit both in 2020 and in 2021. Every credible economist, from the Nevin Economic Research Institute to the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, is calling for government to ring fence this borrowing, to fund it through the very cheap money that's available to Ireland on the international markets, and to allow us in that way to maintain as much of our productive capacity as we can now, to leave us in better stead for hopefully within the next year and a half, 2 years, there might be some resumption of normal life from the point of view of, you know, ridding ourselves of this pandemic. From there, we can work on building this more sustainable, fairer society that has really been pushed to the fore by not just Social Justice Ireland, but by so many other civil society organisations, by so many media commentators. It's really important that this opportunity to create a new and more sustainable society is not missed.
I think you've said a lot there in that last piece, but there's a couple of things that I just want to pick up on. So, you know, in terms of kind of the interplay between the five pillars, I think you're absolutely right. I think it has to be done at the same time. You know, that each of those have a role to play. I think we saw with austerity what happens when you focus only on one thing. If you focus only on the economy, then we see what happens to services. We see what happens to employment. We see what happens to, you know, to society as a whole. We see how damaging it is in terms of sustainability. We see how damaging it is in terms of good governance and social dialogue. And even at a local level, in terms of local government reform, we see all of that. So I think, you know, that point about it having to be across the five pillars is really important. But also, you said something that I found quite interesting in terms of, you know, the budget has to look after all of these different elements of society or these different groups. And I think that to me is probably a dangerous turn of phrase, because really what it needs is to include all of those groups, to take on board the advocacy of those groups where people have their own agency and can engage on their own behalf, and, you know, are listened to and can take part in that decision making that we talked about earlier.
I think that's a good point on which to maybe conclude. And just to remind our listeners that they can access this document at www.socialjustice.ie. As you've probably gathered from our conversation, there are no shortage of policy proposals that we believe are imperative to this creation of the new social contract that the current government has put forward. We will obviously continue to push for them and advocate for them as best we can. And as I say, Budget 2021 will be the first test of whether government is very serious about pursuing that goal.
Absolutely, Eamon.